Good morning. We're now going to begin the study of Megillat Esther over the course of 10 lectures, each of which will be approximately a half an hour. And in this first lecture, we will take a look at some of the overarching issues relating to Megillat Esther, including some of the general problems dealing with the inclusion of Megillat Esther in the canon, and the way that Megillat Esther was viewed by the rabbis in the Midrashim, and then some of the general issues dealing with interpretation and understanding of the Megillah, after which we will take a look at the opening section of Megillat Esther and try to understand it in line and in light of the general introduction that I'm going to give. First note about Megillat Esther. The book of Esther was a hotly contested book, as is recorded in Masechet Megillat Daf Zayin, that whether or not it should be included in the canon and included in the Tanakh, whether it was indeed written by divine inspiration, Baruch HaKodesh, was a subject of much dispute. Famously, it is the only book that appears not at all, not even in a fragment, in the library at Qumran among the Dead Sea Scrolls, which may mean something, may mean nothing, but it may mean that the Qumran sect did not regard it as a holy book. And of course, the Book of Esther is problematic for several textual reasons, chiefly that God's name appears neither by allusion nor explicitly anywhere in the text, nor that there does seem to be a total omission of any religious behavior or religious orientation in the text. Besides which, unlike any other book in Tanakh, any other book in the Bible, Megillat Esther focuses its attention on a diaspora community that neither is in the process of being exiled from Israel and most assuredly is not in the process of returning to Israel. And this sets it apart as what one of contemporary writers referred to as the anti-Tanakh, almost as the square peg trying to fit into the round hole of the books of Tanakh. And so we will have to keep an eye on those issues and hopefully develop several approaches over the course of these lectures to understand why, indeed, not only the Book of Esther is included in the Tanakh, but is regarded with such significance, both in the context of Tanakh and also in the context of the Midrashim and its impact on Jewish history. Some of the specific issues that affect the interpretation and reading of Megillat Esther have to do with the fact that Megillat Esther, more than any other book in Tanakh, although the books of Ezra and Nehemiah on one hand, Daniel in a very different way, are affected by this, is viewed one way if we use what we call standard chronology, the chronological record and dating that most historians accept as valid, especially regarding the dates and length of the Persian Empire, as opposed to what we will call rabbinic chronology or Seder Olam chronology. I'll give a very brief introduction to that just so that we can understand the basis for the issue and we can continue on. There is a midrash, a rabbinic midrash that is associated, attributed to Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, the great Tana of the late 2nd century who lived in Sipori in the northern part of Israel. And that midrash is called Seder Olam. Seder Olam is a midrash which is a history of the world going back to creation and all the way until the times of the destruction of the Second Temple. And what it does is it ties together events by giving years and dates to events that are not otherwise recorded in Tanakh. It is clearly an older tradition because many of the dates and durations mentioned in Seder Olam appear in earlier rabbinic literature. And Seder Olam chronology, while from the conquest of Alexander on, pretty much is consistent with the chronology that historians accept, before that date runs into tremendous conflict. And there are some good books that are written. I believe History and Conflict is one of them. There are some good books that are available on Seder Olam and how to understand Seder Olam and where conflicts. For our purposes, the conflict which is most acutely seen is in the duration of the Persian Empire. Standard chronology has the Persian Empire lasting roughly 200 years, from 539 BCE, with the conquest of the Babylonians at the hands of Cyrus the Mede, until 332 or so BCE, with the conquest of Darius by Alexander Macedonia, Alexander the Great. Rabbinic chronology has a total of approximately 50 years or so of Persian rule, which makes a difference of about 160 years or so, which changes things dramatically. And that's why if you look into those books, which purport to be history books, and which utilize Seder Olam chronology, they will list the destruction of the temple at some point in the middle of the 5th century BCE, where standard chronology, and from everything we know from all of the Persian archives, etc., dates it at approximately 586, not approximately, but exactly 586 BCE, and all of the other dating that we have goes from there. That difference plays a tremendous role in our understanding of Megillat Esther. When reading the Midrashim maintain that the story of Esther happened before the rise of the Emperor Dariavish, under whom the Second Temple was finally rebuilt, and the story happened while the Second Temple was still waiting to be rebuilt, as it were, was in between the process described in the third chapter of Ezra, where the foundations were built, and when it was completed, as is recorded in the fifth chapter of the book of Ezra. And therefore, many of the Midrashim that focus on Ahasuerus's attitude towards the Jews, etc., focus on his attitude towards the potential building or obstructing the building and the completion of the building of the Beit HaMikdash, his utilization of the various vessels and wearing the garments, etc. We'll comment on that a little bit later in this shiur. Standard chronology maintains something very different. The Ahasuerus of the Megillah is almost assuredly the Emperor Xerxes, who ruled from 485 to 465 BCE and followed the reign of Darius I, who came to power in about the year 420 BCE and ruled very successfully until the year 520 BCE until 485 BCE, a very long, a 35-year reign, which I mentioned was very successful. And the chronology works pretty much as follows, that under Cyrus, who was the first emperor of the Persian Empire, who conquered the Babylonians in 539 BCE, and thereupon declared that all of the captured and enslaved people who the Babylonians had transferred to the Babylonian centers in Babylon and Elam, etc., could return back to their ancestral homes, rebuild their temples, rebuild their communities, return to using their own language, etc., as long as they were loyal citizens of the empire and didn't rebel and pay their taxes. And as far as we are concerned in the Bible, that is most significant in the context of the Jewish people, who is recorded both at the end of the book of Chronicles and also at the beginning of the book of Ezra, are told that they may return to Israel, rebuild the temple. Cyrus was going to provide funds for that and animals for sacrifices, etc. And the Jews went back in around the year 536 or so BCE under the leadership of Sheshbatzar, who, as recorded in the first chapter of Ezra, was given all of the vessels that the Babylonians had taken from the temple, and they were taken out of the pagan temple, given to him to return to Jerusalem. In the year 515 BCE, on the third day of Adar, the second temple was finally dedicated after a 20-year hiatus in building for reasons that are beyond the scope of what we need to do here. The interested reader is directed to the fifth chapter of the book of Ezra, and the fourth and fifth chapters of the book of Ezra, for more details about that. And it was built, however, the existence of the temple was quite unsatisfying, and the building itself was not very impressive, and the relationship of the people, and the amount of people that returned to Israel and to Judea, and the relationship to the temple was just not very respectful, not very impressive, and that led to the famous prophecies of the book of Malachi in the middle of the 5th century, where he decried the people's negligence towards the temple, etc. But nonetheless, when Darius passed away in 485 BCE, the next emperor was the Emperor Xerxes, who we believe to be the Ahasuerus of the Megillah, which means that this is taking place 30 years after the temple has been rebuilt and been dedicated. The worship is continuing in Jerusalem, and yet a majority of the community is still living outside of Israel and has not committed to going back. That will play a critical role in our understanding of the Megillah, as the Megillah provides far more than just a palace intrigue, or as some have referred to it, as a burlesque or as a satire. It is indeed a very powerful religious and political commentary about the state of the Jewish people and the location of the Jewish people and their socialization and assimilation. Several specific notes about Parshanut, about interpretation of the text. First of all, it's important to note that every conversation that takes place in Megillat Esther is a translation and not a transcription. There is no conversation that takes place in the text that we have, and I'll note in a moment why I'm stressing the text that we have as the biblical text. There is no single conversation that takes place between two Jews. And even conversations that would take place between two Jews would not necessarily take place in the language of the Bible, because they would be perhaps second or third generation Persians. But certainly the conversations that take place between Haman and Ahasuerosh, between Ahasuerosh and Esther, etc., these are conversations that we have no reason to believe would take place in the language of the Bible, and therefore we are reading a translation. Now, an important note about the methodology of study when we're reading a translation. We have to remember that if we're reading a transcription of a conversation, the words are what the words are. And then we can ask the question of why the speaker chose a particular word or a particular turn of the phrase. That's not the same with a translation. The translation, we have to ask a whole different sort of question. Why did the translator select this particular word or this particular phrase to represent whatever was said in the original? Remember, the translator has a lot more leeway. And if the translator is operating with divine inspiration, as the halakha seems to indicate, because Esther indeed is part of the canon, then that means that divine inspiration is guiding him or her or them, if it's the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the members of the Great Assembly, to translate the conversation between Haman and Ahasuerosh, between Hatach and Esther, etc., to translate it using particular phrases, and then we have to wonder what those phrases are meant to point to, what allusions are there, etc. Which takes us to the second and final point of introduction. And that is that the book of Esther is a very late book of the Bible. In other words, at the time that the events of Esther are happening, and at the time that the book of Esther is being written and finally edited, and as anyone can see from the end of chapter 9 of the book of Esther, it was edited significant years after the events took place, because the text there testifies that the Jews have continued to keep the holidays of Purim for generations. It's important to note that by that time, almost all of the books of the Bible were written and published and well-known and revered by the people, which means that the book of Esther operates not only as an independent text, but also, if you will, as a midrash on earlier texts. In other words, the text of the book of Esther can work as a comment on earlier works in Tanakh. This is a phenomenon which is very well known. I'll give several examples right now. We even have Midrashim inside the Chumash. So for instance, when Avraham takes his trip, the Akedah, that fateful trip with Yitzchak, and the two lads, and the donkey, and the angel interferes to save Yitzchak's life, That is something which is sort of parodied years later when Bilam takes a similar journey, gets up early in the morning, saddles his own donkey, takes two boys with him, is on his way to curse and hurt Israel, and then an angel stops him. In a sense, the story of Bilam's travels plays out as a commentary and an sort of antithesis to Avraham's journey to Har HaMoriah. Anybody who's interested, check the website at Torah.org/advanced/Mikra under the Sefer Bamidbar archives, and you can find an article that I wrote about that topic. Similarly, as the Rambam points out in Hilchot Tmidin Musafin, when the Torah says that the Omer should be brought in Macharat HaShabbat, which led to the most famous and powerful and explosive dispute during Second Temple times about the day of the week on which the festival of Shavuot should fall, the text in Sefer Yehoshua, chapter 5, indicates that Bnei Yisrael began eating the new grain in Macharat HaPesach. And so the Rambam claims in Macharat HaPesach is simply clarifying what Mimacharat HaShabbat in the book of Vayikra means. In other words, that the book of Yehoshua is operating in that context as, if you will, a midrash on Sefer Vayikra. And in that sense, and there are countless examples of that phenomenon, and we'll see many of them in our shiurim on Megillat Esther. But in that sense, Megillat Esther is, in a sense, the perfect text to be used as a midrash on earlier books of Tanakh, because it is one of the last books of Tanakh. And we will see that almost from the beginning, the book of Esther echoes, works as an antithesis, works as a supporting text, etc., all sorts of allusions to earlier texts in Tanakh, which anyone familiar with Tanakh would be familiar with. A footnote to that comment is that Megillat Esther, in a great sense, works on multiple levels, meaning that to a average audience that's reading it either in the original or in translation, it is a fascinating story, and whatever theological assumptions one brings to it will then lead to different messages and lessons that will come out of the text. On the other hand, to someone who is familiar with Tanakh, familiar with the Bible, and in the original, the text carries all sorts of other messages, and if you will, they are hidden messages. I don't mean encoded messages, but I mean rather hidden messages that nuances of the text, Yair Zakovich refers to as Sipurei Bevua, mirror images that exist between our text and earlier texts in Tanakh and create allusions, and many of them we pointed to one famously at the very beginning of the second chapter, which we will get to, God willing, in a couple of sessions. All right, let's begin looking at the text itself with all of that in hand, and let's see what we come up with. The text begins in very grandiose fashion. So it sounds very much like a court document. This came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. Again, Ahasuerus is almost assuredly the emperor who ruled for 20 years in the middle of the 5th century BCE from 485 to 465 BCE, and Ahasuerus, from the historic record, was quite a successful king and one who led his army made a land bridge, and they crossed over the Dardanelles, marched into Europe, and actually were successful in burning the city of Athens in part of the ongoing wars that took place between the Persian Empire and the nascent Greek attack that was 100-plus years away, but that were going on at the time. In any case, Vayimei Ahasuerus, Hu Ahasuerus, again, sounds of great grandeur. Hamolech mehodu v'yad Kush. He ruled from Hodu, which is the Indus River, all the way to Kush, which is somewhere in northwest Africa. Sheva v'esuim me'yam edina. Now, immediately, a sensitive Tanakh reader is going to pick up all sorts of things from this verse. And indeed, we could and perhaps will spend the rest of the session just on this verse. First of all, the grandiose sense with which Ahasuerus is presented here leaves somewhat of a bitter and awkward taste in the mouth of anyone who's reading Tanakh, who's familiar with Tanakh. Because I, as a reader of Tanakh, I know who the real king is. The real king is God. The real king is the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who created heaven and earth. Who is this Ahasuerosh who is being presented as the king of the world, ruler over 127 provinces, etc.? And I get the sense that there's almost, if you will, competition with the divine here in this text. Important to note that the Persian kings, like many other kings, held themselves to be semi-divine. And the title for the kings of Persia was Melech HaMlachim, Malchei de Malchaya, the king of kings, which is, of course, appropriate if you're the emperor over a great empire of many provinces. But that is something which the Tanakh ear, the ear of the student of the Tanakh, will find very offensive and will rub him the wrong way. Well, that's okay. The text means to rub us the wrong way and to upset us a little bit. The mention of Sheva Vasur Miyamadina, 7 and 20 and 100 provinces, which is in and of itself, and of course on the simple level of reading it, builds up the sense of grandioseness and greatness and grandeur. 7 provinces and 20 provinces and 100 provinces, on the other hand, to the sensitive reader who was familiar with Tanakh, reminds us of one great woman who lived for 7 and 20 and 100 years, and that is Sarai. And immediately we are taken all the way to the very beginning of the Tanakh, to the book of Bereshit. And this is significant because, of course, Sarah's name means princess. So here we have a king who rules over 127, and here we have a woman who lived for 127. And in a sense, our curiosity is piqued to see which one of them will have the more significant 127. And we are told immediately in the next two psukim something about Ahasuerus's greatness, which immediately tarnishes the image. Bayamim ahem. And keep that phrase in mind, Bayamim ahem. That is a literary marker used in Megillat Esther, either by Bayamim ahem or Balayla Hahu, to indicate the beginning of a unit. So the first verse we would properly present as a title verse. But now we're at the exposition. We're going to present the background to the story. Bayamim ahem, kesheva tamalach Ahasuerus al kisei malchuto, asher b'shushan habira. Now, there's all sorts of pieces of this verse that are a little bit troubling. We'll take a look at them. First of all, Bayamim ahem, so in those days, kesheva tamalach Ahasuerus, as the king sat on his throne. So we now expect this to be taking place at the very beginning of his rule. This will be immediately gainsaid by what we see in the next pasuk, Bishnat Shalosh Lamalcho, that the events that we're reading about take place in the third year of his reign. So which is it? Is it as soon as he begins his reign, or is it in the third year of his reign? And immediately we have some doubts going on in our minds, some confusion going on in our mind, about whether the events that we're reading about take place immediately or in the third year. A conflict that will never be fully resolved in the text, we'll have to resolve on our own, but I believe that it will be fairly easy to do so once we start getting a whiff of what this man's court is like. Nonetheless, the mention of Shushan HaBira is one that, again, if you're only familiar with Megillat Esther, if you're reading it in a translation, if you're not familiar with the entire corpus of Tanakh, is one that doesn't bother you. By the way, the word Bira, which in modern Hebrew means capital, really means a fortress. And so therefore he was having his throne, he was sitting on his throne, which is in the fortress of Shushan. Good. There's a little bit of a problem here, is that the Persian kings did not rule in Shushan. Koresh took over and ruled in the town of Babel and Babylon, and then he moved his kingdom to Elam, from where the next couple of kings ruled. And then finally Darius moved it to Shushan. So Shushan is a fairly new city, at least as a royal city at this point. But there's another thing that the reader of Tanakh, again, who is sensitive, is going to find very troubling. And this begins a whole series of problems that we have in these expository verses. That is that the word bira, fortress, is one that shows up in Tanakh in another context. That is, in the book of Chronicles, David is commanding his son Shlomo, that when he does, remember, Divrei Hamim Chronicles is a second temple midrash, if you will, on the books of Samuel and Kings, of Shmuel and Malachim, that David is commanding his son, Ki lo la'adam livnot habira ki la'Hashem, that it is not for man alone to build the bira, but rather to Hashem. What is the bira? The bira clearly is the temple in Jerusalem. So So if I, as a Tanakh reader, am reading this, and I suddenly see Shushan HaBirah, I'm going to be offended. Why is he calling Shushan a fortress? I know that in Tanakh, the fortress is the temple in Jerusalem. And with my awareness that the temple in Jerusalem is already standing, although in a diminished capacity and an unimpressive building and virtually ignored by many of the Jews in the world, suddenly my sense of offense and perhaps umbrage will be raised because I feel a certain amount of insult that this man's fortress is being called Habirah, if you will, in competition with my dear Beit HaMikdash. Good. So let's see how that plays out. Bishnat Shalosh L'mocho. And as I mentioned, this is difficult. Why is it in his third year that this event is taking place? What happened for those first 2 years? Asa mishteh l'chol sarav v'avadav. He made a party for all of his ministers and all of his servants. Who are they? Chel parasum adai. So all of the soldiers, meaning all of the army, hapartamim, all of the, if you will, the machers, the important people, Sarham dinot lefanav, and all of the ministers, which means effectively there were three groups that he invited to this big party. Who were the three groups? The military, his financial backers, and his political hacks. And they are all invited to this party. We're going to find out how glorious this party is. Baharotot osher kuvod malchuto. He is showing off the wealth and the glory of his kingdom. Vet yekar tifer gudulato, and the splendor of the glory of his greatness. Yamim rabim shmonim matyom, 180 days. In other words, 6 months, a 6 month party in which Ahasuerus invites all of the politicos and all of the military officers and all of the financial backers, all of the big shots, if you will, to this great party to show off his wealth. Well, I put all of this together and I get a picture. I get a picture of a king who has great wealth. Of course, that great wealth is acquired on the backs of the empire, which means that very likely a lot of people in the empire right now are suffering as a result of the heavy taxation in which he imposed in order to make this great party. This is a very lavish party, as we'll read in the next few verses. And the point of this party is to show off his great wealth to all of the people from his 127 provinces who are people of influence, people of military influence, political influence, and financial influence. Why is he doing this? Well, I put this together with the fact that it is only in the third year that he has this party, and I come to one fairly inescapable conclusion, is that it took him a couple of years to establish himself as the emperor. In other words, there was some sort of a fight for succession, or there were naysayers among the kingdom that he had to put down. And now, in order to win the loyalty of the people whose loyalty he needed most, he threw this lavish party, which means he's investing tremendous political and financial capital in gaining the loyalty of the people whose allegiance he needs the most over the course of a half a year. And he has them come in from all of the provinces, and we have to assume, of course, that they came in on some rotational basis because the provinces can't be emptied out of all of their soldiers and all of their officers and ministers all at one time. They have to be coming in at intervals and replacing each other to come into Shushan and celebrate as part of this 6 month blast in which he shows off, which by the way, showing off both impresses them and they're happy because they get to be at this great party, but it also perhaps frightens them a bit because they see how powerful this king is and I don't want to get on his bad side. We see some descriptions of the party, but before that we're told that there's one other party he throws. And with this pasuk we will end. When these days were done, Asa HaMelech l'chol ha'am ha'nimtzeim b'shushan ha'birah l'migadol v'yad katan mishteh shivat yamim. At the end of these 180 days, he made a party for everyone who lived in Shushan, whether they were great or even small. This is akin to Andrew Jackson's opening up the White House to an open house party, I believe it was in the 1820s. B'chatzar ginat bitan ha'melech. This he held outside in the garden and in the courtyard. We invited everyone to come in. What we will see at the beginning of the next year is the description of some of the items here, but a little bit of a heads up is that some of the terminology used here, for instance, the mention of 6 months. Now, the 6 month mention is something that alludes perhaps to something which is grounded in Midrash and not in the text. which is the interval between the command to build the Mishkan in the desert and when it was finally dedicated. But it's quite clear is that the days in which the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was set up and ready to go, but wasn't yet dedicated, which are 7 days, were called throughout the text Shivat Yimei HaMiluim, 7 days of Miluim. Look at verse 5, Uvimulo Tayimim Ha'ela, he had a 7-day party, which means a 6-month party followed by a 7-day party seems to approximate partially midrashically and partially textually the process of the dedication of the tabernacle in the desert. What the significance of that is something that we will take a look at next time. Everyone should have a wonderful day. And Yirtzeh Hashem, in a couple of days, on Thursday, we will pick up at Pasuk Hey.